I'm Jennifer Rooks from Maine Public Broadcasting. You already met Carol Koldis from Maine Biz. This is going to be a pretty casual panel discussion. Carol and I have come up with a few questions for the panelists. We're hoping that they will feed off of each other's knowledge and energy and kind of take it from there. Thank you all for sticking around. I'm sure this is going to be one of the highlights of the day.
Thank you. We'd like to begin by having each of our panelists introduce themselves and tell us a little bit about what you do. Kirk, could you get the ball rolling for us, please?
Sure. My name is Kurt Adams. I'm the Chief Development Officer of First Wind. We are a North American wind energy development company with operations from Maine to Hawaii. Before I was here, I was in government service for 5 years. My last post in government service was as Chairman of the Maine Public Utilities Commission. And prior to that, I was a lawyer at Bernstein, Shore, Sawyer & Nelson, where I was the vice chair of the Energy Practice Group.
Good afternoon. My name is Ken Priest, and I'm president and CEO of the Kenway Corporation. We also have a marine division, maritime marine. We manufacture industrial composite products, primarily for the power and pulp and paper industry. We also manufacture a line of the maritime marine boats. I have been working in the composite area since 1977, so I've got a considerable amount of experience in heavy-duty, robust composite equipment, and we're looking forward to getting into the wind energy business, and I think we have got a lot of things to offer.
I'm John Henshaw, with the Executive Director of the Maine Port Authority, and the Maine Port Authority invests in the development and maintenance of Maine's port and intermodal infrastructure, and then we market that infrastructure to the to shippers, carriers, and the cruise shipping industry. And I first became involved with the wind industry as we saw more and more components across our piers in Maine to contribute to that industry. And over time, I think that one of the side benefits of that was that there are long lead times in the industry. And throughout the recession, we were receiving components that had been ordered long before the recession started. So our ports ended up doing a lot better during that period than they would have otherwise. But I do see long-term opportunities for the state in this industry.
Good afternoon. My name is Neil Kiley. I'm a director with Corporate Finance Associates. Corporate Finance Associates is an investment banking firm with 28 offices nationwide. The primary focus of the firm nationally is mergers and acquisition advisory services. But here in the Portland office, we also have an expertise in corporate finance. And in that capacity, we've become engaged, especially over the last year, working with a number of entrepreneurs, developers, and consultants in the industry, helping project developers and entrepreneurs seek the capital, both debt and equity, to move their projects forward. Prior to my becoming active in corporate finance, like Kurt, I'm a recovering attorney, and also have been an entrepreneur. I've founded and operated a number of my own operating companies.
Last but not least, I'm Dana Duran. I'm Director of Development at Kennebec Valley Community College up in Fairfield. President John Fitzsimmons asked me to come today to talk a little bit about what KVCC is doing to train the future technicians and current technicians that are involved in energy efficiency. And also, I can talk a little bit about what's happening in the community college as a whole. I think as folks know, the community colleges in Maine have exploded over the last 6 years. We've added 25% in enrollment, and we're really getting involved in trade education, specifically in renewables. Northern Maine Community College is in wind technology. KVCC has been training for photovoltaics, solar thermal, and we were the recipient of a large Department of Energy grant just last week to get further involved in solar thermal and photovoltaic training. So renewables are all around us, and as Habib talked about wind, there's also obviously a lot of potential in solar and geothermal and many, many other areas in the state of Maine.
All right, Kurt, we'll start with you again. And this is the question. In terms of wind power development, how big of an economic engine do you think this could be for the state? And in the broader picture, tapping on some of your prior experience as well, how big is the economic potential of alternative renewable energy in total for Maine?
Thanks. And I'd like to start by thanking you for the invitation to come. I have to travel a fair amount out of state now, and I don't get a chance to be in Portland, and I very rarely get a chance to be in rooms like this with a lot of old friends. And one of the things that I'm struck by, what's going to really drive Maine's economy in renewable energy, is in part the resource. The resource is here. In New England, if you did particularly a wind map, which is what I'm focused on, if you did a wind map of New England, you would see very, very quickly that the lion's share of the developable wind resource is in Maine. Onshore resource, it's in Maine. That's part of it. The other part of the reason Maine's going to be successful in growing its economy through renewable energy is that we have political leadership on both sides of the aisle and in the Blaine House that believe very much that driving Maine's environmental attributes forward and its environmental standards forward can also drive our economy. And they've put policies in place to help make that happen. And the last thing Maine has, which I've really come to appreciate more than I ever really have, is skilled professionals and entrepreneurs who choose to live here and choose to make the renewable energy business work. Now, looking around this room, and also advocates, looking around this room, you've got people like Joan Sachs and Sam Zaitlin and Pat Scully, who've all been in the energy business on one side or the other for decades. And they continue to apply themselves. And where that winds up happening, how that winds up developing, is when a wind energy company like ours comes into Maine, we have very sophisticated advocacy groups on the other side. They are asking the right questions about wind. They're asking the right questions about how to drive wind forward. And then you have all sorts of professionals that can help achieve the goals. And that's extraordinary because in many other states, those things are lacking. And Maine is really positioned very, very well. So how large is it generally? I'll give you just First Wind's perspective. Between now and the first quarter, second quarter of 2011, depending upon building seasons and permits, our company alone will invest somewhere between $750 million and $1 billion in the state of Maine. That's direct investment. That's not all the investment that goes through the ripple effect when you do that. Our company, what we're doing, is being replicated in Maine by at least two other very serious companies who have plans to build wind energy. So you're talking about somewhere between, conservatively speaking, $1.5 billion and $3 billion of investment over the next couple years in Maine in the middle of a recession. That's extraordinary. That's absolutely extraordinary. How big is renewable energy generally? How much can it drive our economy? That's a difficult question. And it's going to be driven primarily by fossil fuel prices. As a former regulator, I never wept when energy prices went down. Actually, when I was on the PUC, I never had that experience because fossil fuel prices were rising so quickly. But the reality is many forms of renewable energy are going to be constrained by low energy prices. And that's not something any of us should really feel that badly about. I mean, consumers are having a very tough time, and low energy prices are a good thing. But it's going to mean certain things aren't going to happen. So you'll wind up getting, in my view, most of the economic growth from renewable energy that's available today and is economic today at the prices you see right now. And those are, to some degree, biomass, to some degree, solar, thermal, and solar. And onshore wind to a very large degree. And if you look at the scale, I think most of the growth is going to come out of wind. Thank you.
Next up, we have Ken Priest, who, by the way, was Maine Biz's Large Business Leader of the Year. We were so impressed with how he transitioned Kenway Corporation from a very traditional manufacturer into a manufacturer position for future industries, primarily in the energy field. And so our question for you, Ken, is how does a traditional manufacturer transition to become a manufacturer of new energy-based components? What are the challenges and the opportunities?
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me to this panel. Kenway was founded in 1947 by my parents, and we started out building wooden boats. We've transitioned into composites in the mid-60s, and then as we moved forward into the 70s, 80s, and 90s, we were primarily in the pulp and paper industry, building tanks and pipes and large structures for that industry. In the late 90s, we saw that the pulp and paper industry was flattening out or declining, and we started to diversify the company. And the transition into wind energy, alternative energy that we're doing now, really is a result of us starting to diversify the company back in the late 90s, where we looked at many other industries, the power industry, which we're now very heavily involved in, wastewater treatment, which we're involved in. So it's been kind of a natural transition for the company, because we're always looking to grow the company. We're looking for new opportunities. We're looking for challenging opportunities. We found that Kenway Corporation, it does its best work when it's really challenged and when the competitor is unable to, is not up to the task. Then we can go in with our engineering folks and our laminators and molding folks, and we can do that type of work. The challenges that we find, we're a small company. R&D investment is difficult to come by. We do not have a whole bag of money anywhere that we can work with. We utilize the DECD, the MTI, FAME. We utilize all of those services. We work very closely with R&D, with the AEWC, with Habib's group. We are struggling all the time for capital money, whether it's R&D or to increase our infrastructure. We doubled the size of our building in 08, so we have twice as much manufacturing capacity. And that was conjunction with community development projects with the City of Augusta, with the DECD, with working with our banking partners. It was a conglomeration of a lot of different ways to generate that capital for a small company. But generating financial resources is a very distinct problem in Maine. Right now we're seeing two or three of our major banks that are currently in financial trouble, and that is affecting some of the businesses in Maine. One of them is in a cease and desist situation right now, and that is not good. Opportunities, as we grow the company, we're always looking for new opportunities. And just as an example of what has transpired as an opportunity, which we did not see that it was there, we were asked to participate with a chemical company in Pennsylvania to develop a new catalyst system for our vinyl ester resins. And this catalyst system is designed for the infusion process, which is the latest technology that is currently being used to build large structures, windmill blades, and things of that nature. This company brought in consultants into our shop, has been there for about 6 or 7 weeks right now, and we have been assisting them in developing the new technology, which is going to allow very thick, heavy structures to be built in one infusion at one time, greatly reducing the labor involvement in the building of that structure and increasing the physical properties of that structure. The test samples, I believe, are going to be at the AEWC at the University of Maine doing physical testing. I believe it's this week that's going to be happening. But what is happening there is we started out as just assisting this company, providing our manpower and our expertise in laminating to assist them in evaluating resins and chemistry. What we found is during this evaluation, anyone that's going to use this product out in the composite industry is going to need special tooling, special molds. They need to be temperature control molds. And as a side benefit that we did not expect, we see a brand new business that we will be able to participate in and share with the composite folks in building heated, controlled, temperature-controlled malls, but also all the training required to do that across the country. What we're seeing in the wind blade arena is there are a number of wind blades that are failing, that they do break, and we're looking at ways with this technology of providing a more controlled, higher quality laminate that will have better physical properties and better quality control. We also are understanding that within the windmill blade business, the molds that they're using are currently have a very short life cycle, and those molds can cost $1 million to $1.5 million. So that is adding a lot of cost to the industry. We would like to see the production of windmill blades here in Maine, and the more that we can do to reduce the cost of manufacturing those blades, the more we'll be able to compete with the folks in the southern part of this hemisphere. And that's where a lot of the blades are coming from. I believe a number of these in Maine have come out of Brazil. And how many in Maine are from the U.S., I'm not sure. But we see those as a lot of great opportunities in this industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken Priest. This question is for John Henshaw, who's director of the Maine Port Authority. Do we have the infrastructure to support the increased import and export of energy components, and how much transport business is out there? How do we compete for it?
Sure, thank you. I would say to your first question, I would say that we do have the infrastructure to handle planned and projects in development for the near term. That's onshore projects. But for offshore, it will take the combined resources of both public entities, private entities, and some additional capacity to handle that business. What's the opportunity? The Maine Wind Energy Act called for the installation of 2,000 megawatts by 2015 and 3,000 by 2020. 300 of those megawatts are supposed to be for coastal waters. Today, Habib mentioned that we're looking at an additional 5,000 megawatts offshore by the year 2030. That together represents a huge opportunity. And how do we compete for that business? We compete through a combination of infrastructure, ability, and experience. And I think that we gain those things by competing effectively for the onshore business and then hopefully applying that to compete for the offshore business.
Neil Kiley, he was, we thought long and hard about who we wanted for this panel who could answer the money questions, because when you're in a room with business people, that's what they want answers to more than anything. So Neil, our question's for you. What are the challenges of getting financing for emerging energy companies in this economy, and how does Maine stack up with the competition in regard to incentives or subsidies to attract or nurture those industries?
Well, I think the first challenge in answering that question is just as there are a diverse number of technology that come under the umbrella of alternative energy or clean technology, there's an equally diverse number of business models that fall under the same umbrella, and each model has its own attributes and challenges when it comes to financing. And I think I've seen most of them over the last 12 months. There's no shortage of entrepreneurs in Maine, I feel comfortable saying. So I think what I'd like to do today is try and distill it down to three categories and try and keep it as brief as possible, but talk about the three categories. And those categories are power generation, energy efficiency, which would also, I would lump in cogeneration opportunities and residential efficiency programs. And the last is really startup and operating companies that are in the clean tech arena serving these various industries. In regards to power generation, the last 18 months have seen developers sustain multiple challenges. The first was the credit crisis, which removed a number of lenders from the industry. The first result that the lenders that were left standing were in the enviable position of being able to cherry-pick projects, which made it much more, the access to credit much more competitive. They also were in a position to demand that developers bring more equity to the table to reduce their risk in these transactions. Unfortunately, at the same time, the traditional investors in energy projects, which are large banks and insurance companies and other large companies, typically invest to take advantage of tax credits to offset their profits. Well, with the recession, not too many people are worried about profits. So I saw some figures where at the height of the market, there were up to 24 companies that regularly invested in these projects. And as of 6 months ago, I think it was down to 4. So you could see there's a number of hits at the same time. In addition, as Kurt alluded to, with another result of the recession is that energy prices declined, which made all projects more difficult to pencil out. Fortunately, you know, the federal government recognized the problem in regards to tax credit investors, and they came out with the stimulus package, which has Section 1603, which provide developers with the option of electing to take a grant in lieu of utilizing tax credits. The regulations for that program just came out in July, and already the federal government is writing checks. And essentially, after your project is commissioned, you simply apply to the federal government, and you're eligible to receive a check up to an amount that equates to 30% of the eligible cost of your project. So again, the regulations for that just came out in July, but already a number of developers have taken advantage of that, and including Evergreen Wind and Danforth, which I believe received $40 million under that program. So it's already having an impact in Maine. Moving, and what we're seeing as a result of that, new investors or other investors are coming back to these energy projects with larger investments. Even though they can't twin the Section 1603 with the existing tax credit programs, a lot of these projects also have accelerated depreciation that comes with it, and so right now there is money flowing back into the sector at the high end. Unfortunately, as we move down the scale in terms of the size of development, the smaller scale developers are encountering greater challenges. The first challenge is that, as most of you know, or as all of you know, I'm sure, is that power generation favors scale, both in terms of technological efficiency, but also in terms of financial efficiency. The cost of permitting a small wind farm is not proportionally less expensive than the cost of permitting a giant wind farm. In addition, the lenders that have the focus and the expertise to underwrite these deals prefer to work on large deals, again, for efficiency's sake. They have internal staffs, they have expertise, they'd rather put out $100 million than work on, you know, $15 or $20 million projects. For the same reason, institutional equity investors tend to focus on the larger projects and are not available to the smaller projects. On the flip side, the smaller banks simply don't have the expertise to get comfortable with the risks that are involved with a small wind farm or a biomass project. So smaller scale developers kind of find themselves in somewhat of a gray zone. Add to the fact that most experienced developers, again, tend to focus on the larger projects. We tend to be seeing sponsors who are newer to the industry and lack the track record that a lot of financing sources want to see. Fortunately, Section 1603 applies to smaller developers, and that, you know, is making it possible for the first time for small-scale projects to move forward. In the past, smaller-scale projects couldn't sustain the transaction costs of trying to syndicate tax investors. And just, you know, a word of caution, this window is going to close fairly quickly. I think October 2010 is when, unless there's an extension to this program, you have to be in the ground or starting construction by then. Maine does have a feed-in tariff, which was recently passed, for projects up to 10 megawatts in size. You can compete for one of two options. The first option is to secure up to a 20-year power purchase agreement, and the second option is to have your RECs valued at 150% of the normal value. It's a start, but at 50 megawatts, it's obviously not a large program. There are other further internal restrictions on that. So we may see some small-scale demonstration projects, but it's really not going to open the floodgates for smaller-scale power. The next category, energy efficiency, I'll just share a story. I was called in to meet with an engineer one time, and I came in. I said, "What can I do for you? And he said, I'm a recovering lawyer. And he pointed out all the binders, you know, filled his bookshelves. And he said, every one of these is a feasibility study of some sort on an energy efficiency or a cogeneration project that has never got off the ground because of financing. And after talking to him and actually sitting in on some calls with customers, it became quite apparent that
many customers either don't have the excess capital in this environment to invest in projects, or their payback, you know, the threshold for non-core investment paybacks is so short that anything beyond 2 years is simply not feasible for them. Some customers are solving this with financing provided by ESCOs. For those of you who are not familiar with ESCOs, ESCO is an energy service company which primarily comes in, installs equipment, and does a retrofit. They usually either provide or arrange the financing, and then the customer and the ESCO share or split the savings above the cost of financing. Typically, the ESCO also guarantees that if the savings don't materialize, they will make up the difference. Customers find this appealing because it enables them to shift the technology risk and the financial risk to the ESCO. However, it's not a silver bullet. ESCOs tend to focus on the federal government, state government, and municipal, you know, facilities, or very high credit-worthy customers. They also have a threshold for the size of their projects. And lastly, I've noticed in talking to engineers, consultants, and construction firms, they seem reluctant to invite an ESCO in on a project for fear that they'll be cut out of the work or, you know, the relationship with the client. Whether that's true or not is unknown to me, but it's certainly a perception out there. On the residential side, it's similar problems. Obviously, homeowners these days don't have a lot of excess capacity. They don't have the same access they had to home equity lines. To the extent lenders are lending to this, you know, for projects, it tends to be shorter term, targeted at the, you know, the credit, the homeowners with the best credit. So there's not a lot of incentive, I think, for homeowners to adopt these retrofits. Efficiency Maine has a new program coming through, and they're doing a wonderful job, I think, to try and streamline their process to make it easy. And I understand they're going to offer some tax credits to try and facilitate bringing various lenders into the market. But I suspect this, we're still going to see a gap there. Very quickly, on the operating companies and startups, you know, they're facing the same problems other companies in Maine have always faced in the past in terms of raising capital. In addition, you know, we have the credit crunch now. Banks are just very conservative, and they're very careful about whom they're lending to, and again, requiring capital. So similar challenges there. I'd like to end this segment on a high note, though, and that I don't want to. Question is, what are the challenges? At the same time, we have a unique opportunity in history for this industry. We have global demand. We have government focus. We have business and consumer demand for products and services and clean energy. And we have an unprecedented amount of programs and resources and incentives available to entrepreneurs. I firmly believe that any entrepreneur that has a well-crafted business opportunity, a professional management team, and is willing to make the effort to invest in a professional business plan that addresses the concerns of equity and financing sources, will be able to secure the capital they need to move forward. Financing simply cannot be an oversight anymore, though. It's not the last part of the equation. It really has to be the driver when you're putting your business together, right down to where you site your business. You know, some of the programs in Maine are tied to census tracts. And if you're not thinking about that, if you have the opportunity to where you site your business, you're making a fatal mistake. In regards to incentives, I would say that I'm not an expert in all the incentives in the 50 states out there, and I'm sure people in the audience can point to specific incentives in their regards to their technology or project that is more favorable than Maine. But I would say that my impression is that Maine is doing a tremendous job in terms of its focus and planning and bringing resources bear to favor these, you know, favor this industry and to favor companies that are trying to get traction in this industry. In addition to the standard incentives of RECs and carbon offset programs under RGGI, as well as funding coming through Efficiency Maine, we have other resources. We have the University of Maine, which has done a tremendous job in securing funding to advance R&D projects, and they have a great track record of working closely with entrepreneurs to advance, you know, private operating companies' technology. We have CEI, which is the biggest allocatee of new market tax credits in the country, right here in Portland. Tremendous resource. Most of the state of Maine sits within rural development and qualifies for USDA programs. So I don't think we have a shortage of resources. I'd also qualify in regards to incentives that lenders sometimes, you know, they're great for us, but sometimes lenders discount the value of incentives because they're a creature of the legislature and they can change. And a cautionary tale in Massachusetts, there was a mandatory renewable portfolio standard for biofuels that a lot of companies were counting on. At the last minute, the state changed the definition of a qualifying fuel, and a lot of companies were left out in the cold. In regards to what other states offer that I think we could emulate in Maine very quickly, I would, again, focus on financing, because all the incentives in the world aren't going to do you any good if you can't bridge the gap to secure the rest of the financing to move your project or your business forward. Two innovative programs I'd like to highlight. One is in Pennsylvania. There's a community development entity, which is equivalent to CEI here, and it's called the TRF Sustainable Development Fund. And they focus on providing grants, equity, and financing to alternative energy projects. And they have developed an internal expertise such that they can also attract outside equity and financing, and they are getting these smaller scale projects up and built, and also clean technologies. Another very interesting program that's we're seeing pilot programs in about 8 to 10 states involves financing energy efficiency retrofits through businesses, to businesses, and to homeowners through a line item on the property tax bill. Now think about this. If you're a lender and you're lending into a on an energy efficiency project, most of the components of that project are deemed fixtures, which means it's impossible to repossess that collateral. And if the homeowner stops paying, you're essentially out of luck. Under this scenario, you're now protected. Your status as, you know, with the collection on the property tax bill means you're senior to the first mortgage. The worst case is that a property goes to foreclosure, payments stop until a new owner takes over, and those back taxes have to be paid off. As a result of that, what we're seeing in the pilot programs is lenders are extending the term sometimes 15 to 20 years, and they're reducing the interest, and they're also not requiring upfront payments. So I'll give you an example of success. In New York, there's a program, there's a pilot program, and in the first month they received a few calls. Now, after a few months, they were up to 50 calls a month. And of those 50 calls, when an energy auditor showed up, whereas in the past they would convert 15 to 20% of the audits to a full implementation, now they're converting 95%. So these are some innovative strategy, more focused on making, you know, the financing as opposed to the incentives, that I think if we can embrace those and copy other states, we can kind of accelerate the rollout and capitalize on the down payment of all the stimulus funding we're seeing.
Thank you, Neil Kiley of Corporate Finance Associates. And finally, we'll turn to Dana Duran with Kennebec Valley Community College. Dana, who are the energy workers of the future? How do we prepare them? And what kind of trends do you see within the energy industry, and how is KVCC preparing to meet them?
It's a very, very good question. I want to thank Maine Biz for inviting me to come today, and I know who I'm going to hire as my attorney and for financial considerations. He's sitting right next to me because, obviously, I don't think I'm prepared to handle any of those decisions. I've been asked to talk a lot about what's happening in the workforce today, and I think, you know, the workforce discussion in many respects is market-driven. And we're all here today to talk about what's happening in the marketplace. The marketplace for energy is quite an incredible place and situation, not only here in Maine, but nationwide. Nationally, what is happening in energy is quite frankly amazing right now, and I think the workforce is a critical component. Speaking from the community college level, you know, we're getting interest and we're reacting to the conversations regarding energy efficiency and renewables, because that's where most of the conversation is taking place with respect to workforce development. Now, I can only speak to the community college level. I can't speak directly to the university level or even, you know, quite frankly, to the high school level, the CTE level here in the state. But we basically look at it, at the workforce in three areas: construction, manufacturing, and service-based. On the construction side, you certainly see what's happening with Chinbro, Reed & Reed, others around the state who are retooling, moving into different areas and taking their current workforce and essentially taking that same workforce and retooling them to do different things, and that's related to energy. And I think that's absolutely terrific what's happening in construction. On the manufacturing side, for a community college, we basically get involved on a project-by-project situation. we'll get involved with companies like Chinbro to hire welders for the Brewer project or the what was happening down here on the waterfront. We'll get involved with International Wood Fuels to help train manufacturing workforce. Ascendant Energy in Rockland has contacted us about potentially training for manufacturing and solar technologies. So we get involved on a case-by-case basis there. In pulp and paper, we have a pulp and paper technology program to train technologists to get inside of paper manufacturing companies in the state. And right now, we've been asked by a U.S. Department of Agriculture grant to start training for biofuels, ethanol, and different ways for the paper mills to be productive in the state of Maine so that they can keep moving forward and take advantage of a traditional resource. And then finally, there's the service base, and that's where the community colleges have really thrived in the last few years and are really carving out a niche of their own. At KVCC specifically, we are looking at the service-based industries for energy efficiency and construction, really, at the middle-skill jobs, and that's what we call them. They're the middle-skill jobs because a lot of them are traditional skill jobs that are being augmented for new industries. We're not changing what a plumber does. We're not changing what an HVAC technician does. We're augmenting that skill set. And we're not really taking a workforce and redesigning them. We're giving them, you know, an augmented skill set to do many different things. So the way we've looked at it is we've essentially looked at it as a three-legged stool. One is electric-based, one is energy efficiency-based, and the third is in the building construction trades. On the electric side, we have electric technology program that has traditionally trained electricians. Now those same technicians are being asked to do photovoltaic installations. Those same technicians are being asked to size and place and construct small wind towers. So you see 30-foot, 40-foot wind towers going up on the side of the road, and you're saying, are they really going to generate enough wind for what those wind towers are being placed at residential and small businesses? And so we're now getting involved to try to help those same technicians not only be able to size them appropriately, but also construct them. And in the future, we're now looking at maybe we train folks for fuel cells. And that will be another area in the future that I think will start to take hold. On the traditional HVAC energy efficiency, we're now looking at it as a kind of a holistic approach. Energy services is what we call your traditional HVAC. So if you have someone come in to take a look at your oil boiler in the fall, or if you have a natural gas propane or a solid fuel, pellet manufacturers, obviously you have to have a pellet boiler in your home, residence, business in order to burn those pellets. So you need folks with appropriate licenses to go ahead and install those. So we're now looking at creating what we're calling an energy services program, which trains holistically for five different licenses so that one tech can come into our program, can become after finishing the program, can go out and take licensure exams to be a plumber, an HVAC technician, an oil burner technician, natural gas propane, solid fuels. And so now we're talking about someone who has a very unique skill set, can do many different things, and I think that's the future of the traditional energy technician in the state of Maine. And then finally, in building science, we're looking at creating a sustainable building program, which includes weatherization and auditing. There's so much talk in the state of Maine nationally on the low-hanging fruit, taking a home or business and trying to weatherize it. First you have your audit, then you have to weatherize it. Well, what do you really need to do to weatherize a home? And then even in a broader reach, there is smart building design, smart building construction, designing and constructing energy-efficient buildings, whether it's residential or commercial applications. So those are the occupations of the future, and in many respects, they're the same occupations of the past. But we have to augment those skill sets, upgrade them, and then provide the opportunity to see what's out there in alternatives. I mentioned before that we've gotten involved and have just gotten a major Department of Energy grant. We were blessed last week to get a $3 million energy grant, photovoltaic and solar thermal workforce training grant. We were one of nine institutions in the country to get one of these grants. We were competing with Penn State University, North Carolina State University, and little old KVCC somehow stumbled upon this and got the attention nationally to go ahead and do this. solar, thermal, and PV, as I mentioned before, are existing skill sets. You have plumbers, you have electricians, and quite possibly you have engineers who then want to go and design and install these systems. And now we're going to go throughout New England and into New York to try to train future instructors who will then take that technology and that knowledge and be able to then, of course, train future students who will then install those systems. So I think the state of Maine is taking a major step forward looking at all of these occupations and then also looking at renewables and making sure we have a creditable, trained workforce in order for that to take place.
Thank you. I don't know about Jennifer, but I've got about 10 story ideas here that just from listening to our panelists in the last half hour, so thank you. The second question that we wanted to ask each panelist has to do with policy, and we asked them to consider two policy changes the state could enact that would enhance his ability to develop an economy based on energy. We asked that one of those policy changes incur costs and one that didn't. So, Kurt, would you be willing to start the ball on that for us?
I'm regretting where I chose to sit. Yeah, and I'm going to have a wholly unsatisfactory answer. Maine is probably one of the best business environments for renewable energy in North America. And it is because of the policy, political leadership that we've had here. It doesn't mean Maine's environmental siting laws are easy. They're not. They're very tough. We have a very rigorous permitting environment here, probably one of the most rigorous in the country. But the laws are very clear. And the permitting process, it could always do for some better tinkering. I mean, we could always make things better. And I think the legislature, being what it is, will always strive to make things better. But by and large, as a wind energy developer, there is very little that I can see on a grand scale that is a significant policy change on permitting and land use. But there are things that can change, and I'll just give you one thought that we've been having. When you get a permit in Maine, it's an adjudicatory process, which is, you know, lawyers. And a regulator who makes an unbiased decision based upon the law and allocating the facts. The problem with an adjudicatory process is that very often people who oppose a project don't have much recourse to the developer. The developer will go and have a conversation. We'll have town meetings. We'll have workshops. We'll do all that stuff. And a lot of people come and a lot of people ask questions, and I would say, you know, most leave satisfied and comfortable with the project, at least with ours. But there is this, once you get into the permitting process and adjudicatory, I think it becomes much more formal, and that's just not the main way. The main way for people to solve problems is to sit across the table and hammer it out. And there probably could be some tinkering with land use laws to try to create a little bit more of a vehicle for folks who have real concerns, legitimate concerns, about projects, to talk about them with the developers and try to get their concerns heard in a more informal way. Now, one policy change that I don't actually think it would cost money, but would probably create a lot of value for ratepayers, and that is long-term contracts for renewable energy credits. We have long-term contracts in Maine for energy, but we don't have long-term contracts for renewable energy credits. And what that means when you're trying to build a project is that lenders, notwithstanding Neil's wonderful advocacy, lenders are loath to provide any value whatsoever to construct a project based upon a renewable energy credit because government policy can change. A renewable energy credit might be worth $35 today. The legislature could decide it's worth $10 tomorrow. And for in terms of the financing of projects, that makes financing very challenging. Thanks.
Ken Priest.
The policy change that doesn't incur cost, as we understand it, and I don't have any personal experience with this, but I think some of the folks in this room do. But folks that are looking for permitting to put alternative energy products in the ocean or on the ocean bed should be able to go to the federal state agencies. And as I understand it, there's a hydrokinetic pilot project licensing procedure that is possible for them to go through. It's supposed to be a streamlined procedure that gets them into the water, deals with environmental issues, and does it very quickly. Some of the folks here that are exhibiting, I believe, can tell us a story of where they go. They have gone to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife on the federal level. They've gone to NOAA, and those agencies just flatly tell them that they are not participating in this streamlined process and that they are going to require them to go through the full-blown permitting process, which can cost a lot of money and take 1 to 2 years to get through that process. What I would like to see is the governor and our delegation show some leadership in going to these federal agencies and discussing with them just what we can do about this and see if we can't alleviate that that holdup, really, of dealing with the permitting. Policy change that requires funding. Maine could provide a financial incentive to alternative energy developers such as GE, First Wind, any of the folks that are doing major developments in the form of tax credits or a policy similar to the Pine Tree Zone, where if those developers purchased equipment, material, services from Maine companies, there would be some sort of tax credit or some method of enticing them to do business with Maine companies. And I don't know if that has been tossed around in the legislature or not, but that would certainly cost money, but it might be something worth looking at. Thank you.
Thank you. John Henshaw.
Thank you. Well, without wholesale changes to our national energy tax structure, I have a couple of more modest proposals that we could do here. The first that would help the onshore industry, and the second that would help the offshore industry develop. The first is based around our property tax structure. I would propose that we amend our property tax legislation so that wind turbine components aren't taxed as property until they're actually installed on site. That's that particular policy is based on some legislation that was probably written in the 19th century, and it had to do with the fact that the tax assessor would go out on April 1st and count the number of buildings in town and then tax people accordingly. That's not really an appropriate approach to take to taxing these components, which ultimately will be installed somewhere and will be taxable, but probably should not be when they're being stored or when they're being prepared for shipment. The second is that we identify and secure what has become an increasingly scarce commodity, and that's land in proximity to our ports. I think that it should be a policy of the state to try to secure as much of this land as we can for future development. Just by way of example, when we visited the that wind farm that Habib spoke of in Bremerhaven in Germany, the government invested some 50 million euros in the property, and that leveraged against $250 million in private investment in that same property. Those are my proposals.
Neil Kiley.
I think I would revisit my earlier comments and essentially copy what's working. So kind of interpreting the term policy recommendation loosely, I would go back to, you know, a initiative that wouldn't cost much money to implement. Obviously, would be the property tax bill financing structure that requires enabling legislation and maybe some seed money, but I think that's fairly easy to get pilot programs going. The other one would be to copy or emulate this idea of a small-scale financing nonprofit institution that has an expertise in alternative energy. We have the framework or, you know, some resources in place. We have the Small Enterprise Growth Fund. We have CEI. We have FAME. And maybe it's a combination of the resources available through those three institutions or the creation of a new institution, perhaps seeded with some, you know, bond money, et cetera, with the expectation they would leverage that public money to bring in private money as well. I'd add, though, as an additional investment within that entity or affiliated with that entity, is the state should consider getting qualified as a regional center, a qualified regional center under the EB-5 visa program. Many people are not familiar with this program, but essentially the way this works is that if you are a foreign investor and you're willing to invest $500,000 into a qualified business that will create 10 jobs, and those 10 jobs last for 5 years, you are entitled to a visa for yourself, for your spouse, and for your family. Vermont has been qualified as a regional center. The whole state is qualified as a regional center. And you may have heard of the Jay Peak Resort, a ski resort that was built for $17 million, utilizing investments from 35 foreign investors. This program is blossoming across the country. It would be a great way, an easy way, to attract capital to Maine, especially if it was linked somehow to an institution that had credibility and expertise in an alternative energy, underwriting alternative energy projects. The best part is that these investors are not looking for venture capital returns. Their primary return is that their goal is to get their money back, obviously, and then to, you know, get the visa. If they get some kind of marginal return on top of that, they tend to be happy. So an easy, innovative program to implement without a lot of dollars that could have a big impact in Maine.
Thank you. And Dana Duran?
Last but not least. In terms of two policy recommendations, one being funded, one not being funded, I would say the one not being funded, and looking at the small-scale installations that are really focused on renewables at this point, we have what the state has really tried to do, and a lot of it has occurred in the last 6 months because of the federal stimulus money, but Efficiency Maine is really trying to do a great job to try to help homeowners, small commercial, even large commercial, put energy-efficient concepts into those applications to try to reduce their overall costs, try to make them more energy efficient. What we've seen from our side is a lot of those installations aren't being done by qualified folks. So, or if they do want to have them done by someone who's perfectly qualified, has some type of national certification, there's a backlog, and here's an example. Photovoltaics, the state has a rebate through Efficiency Maine if you put in a PV system, but the state code says that you have to have that installed to receive the rebate by what's called a NABCEP certified installer. It's the North American Board of Certified Energy Practitioners. Well, in the state of Maine, there are only 4 certified PV installers. Now, for a state this large, if you want to put a PV system in, first of all, it's expensive to put PV in to begin with, and then to try to find one of these folks, it discourages you. It's yet another one in those list of discouraging factors to put one of these systems in. And the effort is good on the behalf of the state and the legislature to try to mandate a national certification to protect the consumer, protect the taxpayer, but you also have to make sure there's a system in place of these actual installers to go ahead and do this. Then on the other side, there are the small wind installations that I was talking about before. In small wind, you see a lot of 30-foot, 40-foot towers going up, and most of us know who have tested wind, and Habib will absolutely back this up, you can't really get large wind until you're over, 60 meters, 80 meters? So we're talking about 120 feet or higher. And so the homeowner, essentially these days, is getting ripped off if you put in these small applications. So if they've spent $18,000, $20,000, and they're not going to see a return on their investment ever, it'll be at least 20 to 25 years, and then you have to involve maintenance in there. So I guess that's on the a policy change that isn't going to make a great budget impact. The second thing I would say that will have a budget impact is to support education and training in the state of Maine, not only at the community college level, but the university level. And we can see through Habib's work, through the engineering department at the University of Maine, there's a direct spinoff between the great research that is done there and the businesses that are up and coming in the state of Maine. I would say the same needs to be done at the community college level, because there is a direct benefit on the state if we invest in education. Every year, the legislature, through the appropriations process, looks at the educational system for cuts. Now, you cannot continue or create an educational and training system for young people coming up or those who want to go back from their workforce to a training situation if continually the state looks at education as an offset in the appropriations process. Take, for example, the state of Connecticut. The state of Connecticut, I went to graduate school in Connecticut, invested $1 billion in the university system in the last 10 years. They are reaping the benefits of that investment by the funds, infrastructure, research, training that they're doing in the state of Connecticut. Young folks want to stay in Connecticut. They want to go to the University of Connecticut. We can do the same thing in Maine. We have the capability. We have the infrastructure, but we need to do it continuously to make sure that this pays off. About 10 years ago, I worked for Governor King and saw the incubator process go through the state of Maine. No disrespect to that process, but the state chose to invest $1.5 million in the biotechnology incubator in Fairfield, Maine, which is next door to KVCC. That has produced no net results to date. So we need to have a coordinated approach to education. It needs to be tied to the universities and the colleges, and it will change the state of Maine over the next decade and beyond.
Thank you very much. We have a little bit of time for questions from the audience. The one thing we ask, we have Donna Broussard, who's going to bring a microphone. If you can ask that into the microphone for when this is broadcast, that was not to scare you away from asking questions. We welcome them. Anybody with questions for this panel?
I'm Susan Ransom from PDT Architects. I have a question about financing. A few months ago, there was a broadcast on public radio. A man came here from Samsø, Denmark. Samsø is an island off the coast of Denmark, and they have made themselves energy independent over the last 10 years through a series of different projects. It's all not all just one thing, but they do use offshore wind. One of the things he said was that they had decided that they did not want to just get a big developer to come and do this, and that they had used some kind of funding mechanism whereby the people of Samsø own the utility. And I don't know whether you specifically know something about how Samsø did it, but I'm wondering if there are opportunities for small investors, and I mean small, micro investors, in the state of Maine. We're obviously going to save money if we do this. We're going to reap a lot of benefits. But can we actually reap benefits on a small scale by investing as individuals?
I did not hear that. I didn't obviously hear the program. But there are there are community-owned or cooperative-owned utilities in Maine. I'm not extremely familiar with them. I know they exist, I believe. There's five of them. Jerry's telling me up front. So that structure is there. But in terms of raising money, it's a very interesting concept. If, for example, in Europe, a number of at least a few soccer teams are actually owned by their fans. So it's not a new concept. In the United States, the securities laws frown on offering securities to non-accredited investors. So it makes it difficult, and that threshold is pretty high. So in a practical sense, your hands are kind of tied in terms of offering, as you said, microfinancing. It's an interesting idea. We do have some programs through the utilities where individual investors can agree to purchase green power, et cetera, or they can check off funding for these projects. But if there was a way to get it, harmonize it with the security laws, I think there's certainly a demand on a small scale that might be an additional source of revenue or income to assist some of these projects.
Good afternoon. Luke Shorty from the Maine School of Science and Mathematics. I've brought six seniors here with me today, and I'm curious what advice you would have to the aspiring scientist, mathematician, and engineer that would make them want to come back to the state and invest in this alternative energy.
Don't go to college in a warm climate. I'll have to redeem myself, I guess. I grew up here, and I grew up in a town where there was an Adams Road, an Adams Lane, and an Adams Drive, where my grandmother had 14 kids, and they all lived, their kids and their kids all lived within a five-mile radius of my house. And so I had that small-town Maine experience, and I wanted to get out of Maine so bad. And I left, and I went to college, and I was one of the first kids in my family to go. And I lived out of state for 8 years, and I came back as an energy professional, and I wanted to stay as an energy professional. And my personal experience has been that Maine is an extraordinary place to live. And one of the things that broadband, a good airport, and wonderful natural resources provide you is if you can get a really good college education by working hard, you can come back here and you can do pretty much anything you want from this state.
And if I could just echo a little bit of what Kurt said, I was of the same situation. I was born here in Maine, raised here in Maine, and went away to college and graduate school and came back. And somehow I convinced my wife to come back here too, and she was from Pennsylvania. So, and it's taken about 10 years, but she now thinks there is an economy here in the state. And, you know, there is a tremendous amount of opportunity here, and you really have to be creative and find it. But as you can tell, there is a tremendous, no pun intended, amount of energy around engineering, trades, things, and manufacturing. There's a tremendous amount of opportunity. So you can create opportunity, but you have to seek that opportunity. It takes a little more time in Maine, but it's there.
I think that any of those students that are interested in staying in Maine, if they look at the composite industry, the work that's being done at the University of Maine, at the AEWC, the composite industry, and like I said earlier, I've been involved in it since 1977. I see more opportunities today than I've ever seen in my life and my career in composites. Composites in Maine, I think, are going to be probably one of the premier manufacturing, educational use items that we're going to be working with, and I think students would have an opportunity to live in Maine and enjoy working in composites, which is a very exciting, non-traditional type of work. A lot of challenges, a lot of new things that are going on, and a lot of opportunity.
Yes, thank you. I've enjoyed and been enlightened by all of your comments. I'm John Slattery from E.S. Bullis. We're an electrical contractor operating throughout New England and New York, particularly in the utility side. My question is, would anybody care to wade in and comment on the fact that inherent in a lot of the presentation, whether offshore generated power, onshore generated power, exporting, moving power across our borders to sell it, is in a way in conflict or dependent upon, if you will, a very elaborate transmission system which is struggling to get built. And that transmission system is really driven by public utilities or publicly owned utilities that really don't have a major commitment to renewable power. So I see in that a conflict. I may be wrong, but does anybody care to comment on that? Because the success of the venture of putting a lot of offshore capacity in or a lot of onshore capacity in ultimately depends on moving that power someplace, and you have to have an elaborate transmission system. So my question is, does anybody see a conflict in that, or does anybody see a problem that has to be resolved on the horizon?
Because there wasn't a run of people to the microphones, I'll take it. I don't see a conflict in it necessarily. I mean, our utilities, since we deregulated in 1997, our utilities in Maine are delivery companies. They deliver energy. they don't have an incentive to deliver one kind of energy over another. And they do have an incentive to create a delivery mechanism that's robust. So right now, there's a case before the Maine Public Utilities Commission. It's a, depending upon how you measure it, $1.5 billion dollar transmission case that a utility, is the Central Maine Power Company, is working very, very hard to get approved. And they seem to be working at it as hard as they would, whether they were somehow more directly incented for renewables or not. In addition, Bangor Hydro has successfully permitted and constructed, you know, a new link to New Brunswick called the NRI, the Northeast Reliability Interconnect, and it was the first new connection to Canada in Maine, I think for two decades or so, and it's pretty significant. So there's actually a lot from my perspective. There's a lot of transmission activity happening in Maine, and the utilities are right in the middle of it. I think the challenge going forward for Mainers, and this is a bigger picture question, is how much infrastructure can Maine absorb? And I think that's going to be a big question going down the road, going down the line. And renewables certainly makes a lot of infrastructure a lot more amenable. But at the end of the day, there is a quality of place in Maine. And I think all of us are going to be challenged to make sure that we all protect that, even those of us that are in the industry. Thanks.
Thank you, Kurt, and thank you to all of our panelists this afternoon. And thank you to Jennifer and